gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room's annual Top 10 episode. This year is 2016. 2016's had a lot of films, a lot of podcasts from us. We didn't do as many review episodes this year, so we're going to give ourselves some extra talking room to tell you about some of these great films that we want you to see because we enjoyed them so much. Because of that, we're going to split this episode into two sections. They're always very lively and long episodes, so we're going to kick it off. Everybody's going to do a top 10, except for me. I'm just going to host and make snarky comments and ask lots of questions. But we're going to go 10, Katie, 10, Patches, 10, David, and then we'll just loop back to start with Katie's 9 and so on until we all get the number ones.
For those of us on the podcast and for those of us listening who are interested in the films that you saw and enjoyed this year, where, when, how can we...
That's what I want him to tell me the films that he saw, even if they're in order.
That I saw that I really liked. I mean, I really enjoyed Swiss Army Man. I really enjoyed Hunt for the Wilder People. I enjoyed various television shows and maybe television shows about O.J. Simpson. Mm-hmm. I feel like we're not going to cover movies that I saw and liked in this episode.
Okay, but really quickly, can you tell us of all like the major franchise films that you've been tracking for years and like digging rumors and all that stuff? What was the one that disappointed you most, and what was the one that most exceeded your expectations?
This is a great question.
Oh, yeah. So disappointed would be Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice, because I can't believe it took him 3 years to make that movie. And then
there was a lot of movie
the one
there.
That I was... Yeah, there was a lot of movie there. The one that I'm pleasantly surprised with is still going to be Doctor Strange for, like, it picked its year very well in terms of it was the... Just the nice, pleasant adventure in a theater that looked really cool and wasn't connected to like 50,000 other movies, which I think was this year's franchise problem. If it wasn't last year's franchise problem, and if it won't be next year's franchise problem, but we're probably not going to see the end of that.
It will be every year's franchise problem as long as we live.
Except for Assassin's Creed.
Spoiler alert.
But if you guys do want to hear more from me, I am going to be doing a lot of year-end stuff over at Storm of Spoilers with the other folks. But here, we're going to hit some film. We're going to hit it hard. We're going to hit it fast. Here we go. Number 10s. We're going to start with Katie Rich, who is, I mean, kicking everything off with ...
A Bigger Splash.
Hey.
I watched on iTunes, as I did many of these movies because I was home all summer, because David had talked about it for so long, which was really exciting. And it's made Luca Guadagnino.
Guadagnino. Hey, I say it like Bill Hader doing an Italian impression.
Yeah, it's me.
Luca Guadagnino. Yeah, when you have a super Italian name like that, you may as well go for it. Anyway, the director of I Am Love, he kind of has this collaboration going with Tilda Swinton. And somewhat, one of my colleagues tweeted a while ago that her favorite movie genre is We Are Very Rich and Oh, Someone's Been Murdered. And this really fits that genre really well. I don't want to talk about who or why, but, you know, it's this kind of bedroom drama set on this gorgeous Italian countryside house. And there are all these relationships and weird people. And Tilda Swinton is a rock star who's on vocal rest, so she can't talk. And then some shit goes down. And then Ralph Fiennes dances for about 3 minutes, which was one of my favorite things that I saw all year. It's not light because it gets the murder involved, and I think it's got ideas in its mind, but it's a very easy watch, and you're kind of just like rambling around this house with these people, and people come in and out, and you're not even totally sure who their friends are. It looks like the great summer vacation that I didn't get to take. But I think having all those actors in one room together, playing these really fascinating characters, and then really doling out the drama in the second half, it's not a bad way to spend your time. I like the way this guy makes movies that are lived in with these kind of weird, very specific people, and he can keep making movies with Tilda Swinton forever, as far as I'm concerned.
It's a sexy movie.
Yeah.
It's,
oh my god.
Cool,
yeah.
Movie too. I mean, like just those opening flurry of shots, the way that he gets us into this world, setting up Tilda Swinton as like female androgynous female Bowie, and then cutting to her on her island sex paradise, and then Ralph Fiennes flying in on the shadow.
Island sex paradise.
it's a very cool movie.
I feel like Mattia Schoenaerts doesn't get it up because Ralph Fiennes kind of shows up and steals the attention, which is the plot of the movie, but also what's happening on screen. But Mattia Schoenaerts, he's real great in this too.
Such a good actor.
But Katie, who else in this movie, if you had to, I don't know, pick a name out of a hat, is also surprisingly phenomenal?
I mean, okay, so I haven't seen 50 Shades of Grey still, so I don't have a ton of Dakota Johnson bias, but she's pretty good. I don't know, the character is like not as interesting as I think everybody else.
I think that might be fair about the character, only because the other characters are so interesting. But I thought Dakota Johnson was just knocked this out of the park. I mean, I was like, I never had any particular antipathy towards her. I enjoyed the 50 Shades of Grey movie more than most, but she had never really done anything that struck me as impressive. And I was just like, I will never disrespect you again.
Yeah, and it's not easy to be paired up with Ralph Fiennes giving that performance and hold your own. And well,
what,
she definitely
what
does
is it
that.
About that role? Just for people who haven't seen it, she plays Ralph Fiennes' daughter. Am I remembering correctly? And that she,
yeah,
she
and
she
it connected like, very recently.
Ditching
she
college,
existed.
And
he didn't know she existed until she was an adult, effectively. And so they
and
are
she's
very,
exuding sex like
and
she wants
very
that sex with everyone.
Feely.
Yeah, it's creepy, but also hot. I don't sorry. I don't know.
Hey, I watch Game of Thrones. I like some incest, some light incest in my stories.
It is a plot point that it is brought to his attention that it looks inappropriate. And that is it, but the movie is a lot less concerned with anything that might be happening between them, as much as it is how she is looking to sort of disrupt all of the various use her power as a young young sex bot who has had not had a relationship with her father, and now that she does, is learning a lot very quickly.
I guess it's the curse of being intoxicated in the way that this movie makes so dreamlike in the beginning. Like, you just want to guzzle wine and dance around the beach and like take all your clothes off and be with these people. It's amazing.
And ignore the migrant crisis that's creeping up along your shores.
And then it all kind of slams into them. They all fall apart. It's a bit tragic, but it's such a good movie. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't really go on a summer vacation for a while because I was busy with a newborn. So I watched this movie and I was like, I need
the
sun.
But when you say you didn't go on a summer vacation for a while, you mean like you just didn't go on one this year? Like I would say, I haven't been on a summer
vacation. No, like I haven't been like locked
way
in
too long, too many years.
David, go to the beach. You can take the subway.
Go to Cuba now.
Sure.
Well, if you don't want to take the subway to the beach, maybe you could take the bus. And you'd be maybe with one of Matt Patches' favorite on-screen characters of this year, right? Right, Patches?
That's right. My number 10 is Patterson, the new movie by Jamie Jarmusch, which I think Katie just watched like hours ago.
I watched it hours ago.
Did you enjoy it?
I did.
I fell hard for this movie. I'm a pretty big fan of Jarmusch's. I'm not that familiar. I'll say this. I love movies about poetry. Jane Campion's Bright Star is like a gem that I adore that I don't think many people have seen or no one talks about. I don't think it got great reviews, but I just like movies about people reading poetry. And a large portion of this movie is Adam Driver as the bus driver, Patterson, who drives his bus around Patterson, New Jersey. Connections.
He's named Patterson and lives in Patterson. And that's just kind of shrugged off as
a very
Jewish-y. Man.
Plot thread. And and he spends a lot of time writing and reading poetry. And the whole movie could have been that for me, and I probably would have swooned for it. But it definitely sent me down a rabbit hole reading about Patterson's favorite poet, who is William Carlos Williams, who wrote a book about an epic poem called Patterson. And he was from New Jersey. And something really struck me about his attentions of that epic poem that I would relate to Patterson, the movie that I see, that I really felt while watching it, but probably couldn't put into words. But William Carlos Williams wrote that he, in his epic poem, he wanted to capture the resemblance between the mind of the modern man and the city, and that his poem would speak for us in a language we can understand. So it wouldn't be kind of esoteric and difficult to decipher, that he would capture this relationship between man and the city with very plain language. And I feel like that's what Patterson, the movie, does so well. It's about, you know, breezing through this world that we live in that we probably take for granted every single day, and learning about our poetic surroundings. And it, for me, it was like, It was like watching moving Edward Hopper paintings or something. All these little micro interactions, the kind of lyricness of the world around us. And not much happens in the movie. There's some, you know, Jarmusch-y encounters and drama and craziness that Patterson encounters in his week in the life of. But for me, it all just struck me as being very aware and not a Luddite's approach to the world. There's a lot of talk about put down your technology, and his wife in the movie, Adam Driver's wife in the movie, is someone who has artistic ambitions similar to.
And she's a controversial character.
Yeah, I would want to hear you talk about her, but for me, she was, you know, most of us. She's this proxy for ambition and creativity, but commercialized and displaced from what it's like the true meaning of artistry and poetics. And it's an interesting contrast that those two are in love for some reason. They live together. And his world, it's not collapsing, but he's struggling in this place that is kind of advancing beyond poetry that he knows. And he keeps finding it in the corners of his little town. And it was such a wonderful, I don't know, rambling little movie. What did you guys think?
Well, here's a question for you. I don't know anything about the William Carlos Williams poem that it's kind of inspired by, but you talk about it being about modern man. Is the fact that Patterson, the movie, is such a throwback kind of against the purpose of that? Like, you've got this guy kind of making a blue-collar living as a bus driver, and his wife doesn't have to do anything, and it all feels kind of like a fantasy. Like, that's something you could have done in the 50s.
But is it a fantasy? Now, I mean,
he doesn't have a cell phone very deliberately. I don't
might
know,
be a like, lot of the world.
I don't know much about the economics of Patterson, but I think it's hard for a lot of people to live like that, like have, you know, spare time to like write poems as opposed to having to have a second job to keep up with the mortgage. Like, that seems just like the economic realities of being able to be a blue collar artist.
Well, I mean,
don't seem as realistic anymore.
His job pays his bills. They live in a tiny little house and he goes to the bar at night. And
sure,
it doesn't seem like they're living beyond
the
means.
Like, there definitely is a throwback vibe to this. Like, it's set in modern day, but
I
like with
don't
a few.
No, well, that's
easily be set in the 50s.
Yeah, it's hard to
tell. I got a poetry question. Patches, does it feel like a Carlos Williams like movie? Like, if you were to, since you've gone back and done some of the reading, I remember in high school, he's very like staccato, but can bring out, I think, things in between the words. Does the movie try to function like that?
Well, I think that a lot of Jarmusch's movies are already like his poetry, observational, rhythmic, and not too concerned with rhyme. I guess from a cinematic language standpoint, one scene doesn't have to make complete logical sense after the next, or the motions of these characters don't have to follow traditional story arcs. So in that way, I would say yes, but also because that's how Jarmusch has operated for a long time. But David,
I think that like Jarmusch's register is similarly focused on, as Patches was saying, on the everyday, on the banal, and finding the beauty and the rhyme therein. And I think that one of the strongest things about this movie is how he milks really, truly incredible little moments and comic visual gags from things that are you would overlook in your own daily life. This film features one of, I don't think it would be overstating the case to say, one of the great dogs in all of movies. He won the dog who unfortunately died shortly after making the movie, but won.
What a way to go!
Posthumously, I believe the first ever posthumous winner, the Palme d'Or, which is the highest honor that a dog can win at the Palme d'Or. There's a beat towards the end of the movie involving the dog that, like, I haven't seen this movie in about 6 or 7 months, but I saw it with my fiance, and we still talk about that moment regularly.
What I kind of want to know what moment you're
I'm surprised about. You just can't think of it off the top of your head. It involves, I'll tell you off pod, as they say.
Okay. My favorite moment, I don't think is a spoiler, is Adam Driver has this interaction with these, like, you know, very, you know, swaggery dudes who are like, man, that dog, this kind of dog is going to get kidnapped, going to get dog jacked. And then he ties the dog up outside his private bar and says, it's going to get dog jacked. And he's so nonplussed by the notion of dog jacking.
So the wife character who is played by an Iranian actress named Goldshifteh Farahani. I'm sure almost anyone out there can do a better job of pronouncing her name than I, but who you might recognize from some films that played over here, like About Ellie, is she, and again, I shouldn't really speak to this because I haven't seen the movie in so long, but she is a very eccentric character. She stays at home and just flirts around with her various moods and has a different idea for her future, a different dream to follow every day. And I think a certain population of people, and I felt this to a certain extent as well. Certainly my fiance did, a number of other people, both men and women, found her to be a bit of a male fantasy, a bit annoying. But
manic pixie dream wife.
Manic pixie dream wife. But I also, there have been a number of very cogent analyses out there that have, that I wish that I could better recall the specific points they made, but I remember finding them convincing, that argued that her, the balance between them and what she was expressing was not sexist and very close to the heart of what the movie was trying to say. So I would point you to, if you feel that way, if you didn't feel that way but want to reaffirm how you felt, I would encourage you to poke around the internet and find some good writing on it.
Yeah, I mean, just to speak to that for one second, I'm not exactly sure how someone would see it as sexist, I guess, because she is more reckless, or she is wayward and he is steady and we're supposed to side with him.
She's a little flighty, which I think can be a female stereotype.
I don't see her as flighty. I just see her as immersed in her creativity. She has so many ideas and she's good at a lot of things. I mean, one of the threads of the movie is she's going to bake so many cupcakes and they're really good. I mean, according to everyone who tries them, I guess that's just Patterson, but she makes tons and they sell out and she's doing a good job. She's just a commercial artist and she only sees herself as product, and she wonders why Patterson doesn't publish his poems. That's another thing. He writes and writes and writes, but he never shares, and she doesn't understand that. And the movie, I don't think it's, I mean, because it's a man and a woman, I guess the gender politics of that is baked into it, but it really just seems like one side of art and the other side of art, and they're not, one isn't wrong necessarily, one just may not function as the passion may not be unleashed if you are just gunning to be a famous person or to have yourself published. I don't know, it's tough, but I guess I can see the sexist angular,
there is a
but,
it's interesting that I don't know, a movie that could be read as sort of not an attack on fame but really sort of piercing the veil of fame and looking at these workaday poets, stars an internationally famous actress and someone who, faster than maybe anyone else in Hollywood, is rising from being a supporting character on an HBO show to being, you know, one of the leads in a new Scorsese film, as well as the villain in the new Star Wars trilogy. Anyway.
He's got a voice. So,
David, I think I thought of the dog when you're thinking of. I'm just going to use one word. I think I know what you mean.
Yes.
Mailbox? Yes. Yeah.
On that note.
Well, for us.
No, that's one of the best payoffs to a joke I've seen in a movie. Maybe
for us normies, listeners, podcast is opening wide on December 20th. Patterson is opening wide on December 28th. Podcast is opening wide right now with David's number 10 pick, which is After Your Heart, in interesting ways.
Oh, I thought you were,
but I haven't seen. So
after,
expand.
After the commercial break, and then I realized that we don't have sponsors.
After the jump.
No.
This is a product of me listening to the podcast now that I expect these things. my number 10 of the year, and I should preface this by saying that I make a top 25 list every year. You can watch it on the internet in video form, and I like so many of these movies, and I think that especially, you know, it's sort of arbitrary when you're ranking these things. If you're only making a top 10, you sweat a lot harder about what falls into that 10th spot and then above. But I don't give myself that same problem.
Do you remember your top 10 from last year, David?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. Does anybody else remember what David's number 10 pick was?
What?
He gave a very similar speech.
Oh, I did? Okay.
I
remember, like, because I made the video and I have to think about it so much, I remember what was on it, but I just wanted to say that there are a lot of great movies that are not on my list that I had to choose The Love Witch, which is number 10, over a lot of great movies.
No one's going to judge.
But I really did love Anna Biller's second feature, The Love Witch, which is such a nuanced, passion project that's made as an homage to the Technicolor melodramas of the 1960s. It stars a woman named Samantha Robinson, with whom I was not previously familiar, who gives not only one of the most committed and hypnotic performances of the year, but one that is so, as with everything in this movie, so beautifully in tune with what is happening on screen. I mean, Anna Biller did so much on this film. It's so sprung from her own imagination. She made the costumes. She scored the. She provided the, you know, the absolutely perfect score. She the production designed the hell out of this thing. She wrote and directed it, of course. But it all threads such a small needle between camp and sort of erotic drama and psychological horror. And it never wavers in the tone, which is one of the more high wire acts I saw on the screen this year and in a long time. It tells the story of a woman named Elaine, who is a love witch, who is a classic dictionary definition narcissist, which feels timely in a way that all of a sudden everything bad feels timely. And she is driving down the coast of California after having, well, she's got a dead husband in her wake. And we learn very soon, because she doesn't believe that she has any sort of guilt in this process, that she was effectively responsible for his murder. She's desperately on the hunt for love. She makes these potions which make men fall in love with her, which is funny in its own right because she's beautiful and self-possessed to begin with and completely discounts all of her charms, believing that she is desperate to be worthy and earn any man's love, regardless of who he is or if she has any interest in him. And then they love her so much and so intensely because of the drugs that she gives them that either they asphyxiate and die on the strength of her tonics or by some other means because they become annoying to her. There's a whole side plot involving a local satanic cult. It looks a lot like Jacques Demy's. Like my favorite reference for this movie is the film that Jacques Demy made called Donkey Skin, which has this sort of foreboding fairy tale quality to it. I think this is a really terrific movie. It is more and more I find it rewarding to watch movies that from the top down know exactly what they are and feel completely uncompromised about being that thing. And that is something that I certainly don't think any argument against The Love Witch could take away from
it. Would you compare it at all to La La Land in the way that it's throwing back, you know? I think some people would knock.
Because the Jacques Demy reference?
Well, no, I would just say that I think some people would knock a film for being a throwback, being nostalgic, like taking on the shape of something old, as if that is ideal.
Well,
I'm just curious because La La Land works for you in that same way.
Well, both La La Land and The Love Witch are not simply reviving an old form. It's not, I think, a film like Down with Love, which is a film that I also enjoy, but
yeah.
I think is a little bit more single-minded in its pursuit of the past and resurrecting these old forms. That's one thing. I think that both The Love Witch and La La Land are more interested in mediating between the past and the present and using these old forms to express something about, A, their enduring relevance, and B, are the world in which we live now and the difference of what's happened in our world and how things have changed since this one sort of reference point that they're using as the basis of the milieu here. And the modernity of telling the story now. I mean, there is a veneer of the present that you get with The Love Witch. It feels like a movie that is made in 2016. It feels like a movie that is engaging with, sexual dynamics and gender norms and whatnot, and how we have a slightly more evolved sense of relationships and how they work and the various roles that we're supposed to play now than we did then, and seeing how this old aesthetic form complicates that and vice versa. And La La Land does a similar thing, albeit towards different ends, but I do think that it's very interesting how The Love Witch does it. And Anna Biller is just so on the ball about that from start to finish. She never lets the story, I mean, I think the knock against this movie that I've seen is that the story sort of recedes into the background and that it is not super plot driven and really just sort of sinks into its atmosphere. I think that's fair enough, but she does a great job of resisting the temptation of letting the fun of being in this world get away from her. I mean, she really holds that balance, and balance drives her main character insane.
Is it out on VOD yet, or it didn't really get a wide release?
It was shot on 35mm, and at least at some venues projected in 35mm,
wow.
And so it's not the kind of film that is rushing to be able to stream on Netflix or download on iTunes. It is a lot. It is very much about the experience, about going to a dark, maybe even seedy theater somewhere, and with a crowd of who knows, and enjoying it. But I do think in all the talk of the overdue talk about representations of women on screen, I thought that this was one of the most interesting, challenging, and despite its reference points and its value as a nostalgia piece, one of the most progressive depictions in a long time, and is the ultimate, at least this year, of depiction does not equal endorsements, which is always something worth reiterating.
Well, that was a nice way to end what I was going to make a joke about how Samantha Robinson's cheekbones go on for days, but great. Let's also be representation and, equal here. speaking of, Katie, your number 9 pick isn't actually a movie, which I'm in love with because I've actually seen your pick and agree with you that it's compelling streaming television, I guess.
I did this partly to annoy David, but also because I kept trying to fill in the rest of my top 10, and I couldn't think of much that I liked better than this, which is the nosedive episode of Black Mirror, which premiered on Netflix a month ago or so. A lot of movies that are eligible for Oscars and considered movies premiered on Netflix and were in theaters just long enough to qualify for the awards, so it's a real tiny distinction, I think. I don't actually know if it's long enough to qualify as a feature, though. I don't remember. It's about an hour long.
I think so. I mean, everybody has different standards, okay. But I think by the Academy standards, it's an hour.
64 minutes or something random, minutes. Like just over the cusp. Yeah.
All right, so maybe not quite there. But anyway, Black Nosedive, I think, is the first episode of the new season of Black Mirror. It's directed by Joe Wright, who is one of my favorite filmmakers, even when he's making things like Pan, which I liked,
like Pan,
and no one
Katie.
Else did.
Don't you worry.
There you go.
You guys are weird.
And it stars a... It stars Bryce Dallas Howard, who you may remember being terribly misused in Jurassic World last year, even before she ran around in heels. And it's I know we talked about it on this podcast before I'd actually seen it. Joanna was kind of the beating the drum for it then. But it's set in this not-so-distant future world where you rate all of your interactions the way you would rate an Uber driver. But it, you know, helps determine who gets good jobs and who gets good seating on airplanes and who interacts with who. And Bryce Dallas Howard is this woman who's completely consumed by getting a better rating and kind of partly through no fault of her own and then partly through this consuming ambition, her life completely falls apart as a result. She is really wonderful in it. She's really funny and scary at times. Cherry Jones shows up briefly in a really great supporting part. And it's just pitched enough to be a big satire and kind of silly, but has so much resonance, not just for like the way that we're attached to rating each other and how our phones are ruining our life, which is kind of every Black Mirror episode, but the femaleness of it and the way that it's women judging other women and kind of gets at the way that women want to be accepted by society and will kind of consume themselves in order to get there. And which is why it's so fascinating when the Cherry Jones character shows up as someone who has rejected all of this, but you kind of see where that lands her in society. I thought that Black Mirror can sometimes be really obvious with its themes, and I think this one works with that obviousness in this really great way, and it looks fantastic. And unlike San Junipero, which is kind of this nice emotional story, it's got a little bit of bitterness to it, which I think every good Black Mirror episode does. And it's, I don't know, it's like as good as any movie I've seen and as thoughtful. So,
well, it's not as good as 8 other movies you've seen, I would say.
You know as well as anyone that when you some of these number designations.
I think Bryce Howard is phenomenal in this. I think that, you know, when the material allows her to be great, she is always great. Aside from your Lady in the Waters and Jurassic Worlds. Where
see Pete's Dragon.
Pete's Dragon.
Yeah, I didn't see Pete's Dragon.
Pete's Dragon. She's great in Melancholy, in Manderley. She's great in The Village. She's great all over the place. And she's great here. I just found as with many, if not all, Black Mirror episodes, the whole thing to be a little bit finger-wagging and didactic, particularly the very last scene that really limits my enjoyment of it.
I was going to go the opposite way, where I think most Black Mirror episodes, there's like the scene with the premise and then the scene where it pays off, whereas I feel like Nosedive, for me, the more enjoyable scenes were just watching the inevitability of what's happening to her sort of being acted out, which is like nice as opposed to like the shut up and dance one where they're watching it through the internet, where it's like as soon as you know the twist is that one, it's not like you're going to go back and watch the bank robbery again. I feel like Nosedive is like instantly rewatchable.
One point, yeah. It's like Pee-wee's Big Adventure, except with
yeah.
Well, it definitely has that Burton aesthetic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's like, you know, it's kind of like watching a joke basically play out. Like, how much worse can things get? But it's got it's set within the world so distinctly that it's kind of funny to watch and then also terrifying. I don't know. I've thought
but
of
it's
it
funny
so
that,
many
like,
times.
Oh, sorry.
Especially, as soon as the episode was over, Netflix said, did you enjoy Nosedive? Rate it. And I was like, wow, yeah. Netflix, you don't even know
but
the
it's
context.
Funny that one of the symptoms of the rate everything app culture in the episode is that everyone is exaggeratedly nice to one another, when in reality, I do not think that that has been the effect of social media.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, also, like, very vague secret, don't rate things on Netflix. Its percentage on its your choices is so small, it's not worth the time to click on the stars.
Yes, I.
Pro tip, Patches. Do you have any pro tips for aspiring politicians based on your number 9 pick? I could think of one pick-based pick you might be able to do.
Well, and taking a cue from Nosedive, maybe put away your phone. Maybe you don't need one.
Yeah.
I picked Wiener, the documentary that we have discussed on the show before. You know, is it as good as O.J. Made in America, the monolithic documentary of this year that people can't stop arguing about? I don't know, but I let that one go because it is in limbo and a million other people are going to talk about it. And I don't know. Wiener really struck me as true tragedy and has been, you know, recontextualized over and over and over again this year, from seeing it earlier and then the new Wiener scandal and then the actual election. Everything has put this film back into the conversation. And it's because of access, and it's because of a relentless mission from Josh Kriegman and Elise Steinberg, who had really never made a documentary before, my understanding, the directors, and, you know, they were just driven to capture everything and be frank about it. And Wiener, Anthony Wiener, during his campaign, 2013 campaign to be the mayor of New York, let him, you know, this is ego empowering his campaigns, empowering this documentary, and empowering his downfall. And it's just all swirling together. I absolutely love this film. It taught me so much about the political machine. It taught me about political empathy. I thought it was really interesting that I felt bad for Wiener at times, that he couldn't just talk about politics. He had to talk about optics, and he had to talk about scandal. And you feel for him at times, but he's a disaster of a human being. And maybe that's what it takes to be a politician. As we know, yeah, it actually does. You have to be a disaster to be a successful politician in America.
I felt bad for Anthony Wiener because he has to be Anthony Wiener.
He's cursed.
He's just, he can't, and I think it's proven by what happens in his documentary.
Huma, his wife, you feel so much compassion for her because she understands that he's cursed, and she does believe he's a good man, I think, over the course of this film. And even when she was divorcing him this year over this crazy scandal with him taking pictures of himself, you know, with his kid in his bed or whatever, ugh, all of this, it's disgusting. You know, I felt for her because I still think she feels he's a good politician, that he's a good man who has mental issues.
Well,
and
yeah,
watching her up there is true tragedy, the most tragic thing I've probably seen all year.
Yeah, I certainly thought this was a tragedy, still do, but especially when I first saw it back in January, thinking that the tragedy of Anthony Wiener is that he actually genuinely cared about his constituents. He genuinely wanted to improve life for the middle class in New York City.
Those scenes in City Island when he's just begging people to listen to him and be like, I want to help you look past all this stuff. But
and the
you don't know what to believe, can you?
Things that were not relevant to his ability to lead the city and to serve these people were being sensationalized to bring him down. And I have yet to go back and revisit it and grapple with how my take on that has changed since he has had a pretend, you know, he's been involved in a story that had a much greater effect in the world. But it is crazy watching this movie to imagine this one guy whose life was derailed by sending dick pics of, you know, shrouded dick pics over the internet, whereas a guy who just uses the internet to reinforce how much of a dick he is all the time, wah, 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 is now our president. So it's
yeah. I don't know if I could watch it again at this point. I think I might need some distance from the election before I could.
Yeah, I mean, the big lesson here is the only reason a woman named Sydney Leathers is going to chase you through a McDonald's in New York City with a camera crew is because you fucked up. No one can bring that upon you except yourself. So that's the major lesson of Wiener and one of my favorite movies of the year.
It's a great movie.
Oh, pardon me. Got to cut that out. David.
Yeah.
If you were to end up forever alone, what kind of animal would you be?
That's a very good question.
Wait, did David put Sing in his top 10?
If you were to join a singing competition as an animal.
I would be a Wolverine, but of,
nice.
Of the X-Men variety. Which brings
me nice.
To my,
a Logan
that's
Wolverine.
A person,
my number
David.
9 pick, X-Men. The, whatever the fuck that means. Apocalypse. No, my number 9 pick is Yorgos Lanthimos' The Lobster. Which feels like it came out forever ago now, because a lot's happened since this.
Yeah, this is like a revival movie at this point.
2015, not quite as much as The Witch, which was we first screened in January of 2015. But The Lobster is Yorgos Lanthimos' first English language film, and here is a guy who lost absolutely nothing in translation. Lanthimos having previously made films like Alps and more famously Dogtooth. And a few before that. And I think if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably familiar with The Lobster at this point, a movie about a alternate future or alternate present, it's not really important, where people who are not coupled up are forced to go to a hotel, where if they cannot couple up there and find a suitable mate for them to spend the rest of their days, after 45 days, 41 days, some amount of days, are transformed into an animal of their choosing, unless they find a way to escape and run into the woods with the resistance, which is led by Léa Seydoux. And Colin Farrell, never better than he is here in the lead role. So annoying to watch how fucking frumpy and let it all go fat he is in this movie. And then just a few months later, see him in Harry Potter, where he looks like the model of
that
the
should
old,
give
like,
you hope.
Neo-Nazi
that
movie.
Should give you hope.
No, but it's
you
not,
can
it
transform.
No, but that's not. It's the people who. People whose like genetic makeup allow them to like they're so naturally thin that they have to put in all this great effort to expand, and then as soon as they wrap on their final shot, their bodies just go to and like back to.
And they are paid incredibly well.
Not for the lobster. I don't forget that. I have a feeling that Colin Farrell did not exactly make Fantastic Beasts money on this one, but he certainly earned it.
But then he made so the Fantastic Beasts money paid for the trainer.
Yes, indeed.
And the magic.
But I just thought this was such as clever and droll and morbidly so as any of Lanthimos' movies. It's also just a fascinating examination as to the sort of societal structure of the how relationships are often a construct. Certainly monogamy can feel that way. Analyzing the value of it, what we really get from other people, what it is that we are looking for in another person, because the only metric that people in this movie use to decide if they're right for someone else is if they have really superficial things in common. That gets like everything here amplified to an amusingly exaggerated degree. Like someone thinks that if someone else is blind, then they have to be blind too. Or if their arm doesn't work, then they have to hurt their arm. I mean, they're like injuring themselves. They're physically reducing themselves in order to have a greater overlap with the people who they might be with. But I thought this was such a weird Black Mirror episode in its own right, almost, and that it really tackles this one concept so head on through the lens of allegory, but with like a rare directness that it really becomes bottoms out the other side and becomes a really interesting and ambiguous depiction of modern love and its value and how we go about it.
Is this a more valuable movie for single people or for people in couples?
Well, I think it probably has a different value for both.
Oh, okay.
Most of us have been both.
Right.
So you can kind of easily conjure one or the other.
Well, if you've only been one, then you've obviously only been single. Because, right? No one gets born married, maybe?
That's the name of my memoir.
I mean, it definitely has a pretty...
no one gets born married.
It definitely has a pretty cynical... it has a pretty cynical view of the value of partnership, I think. I think it's, you know, if you want justification being single, watching The Lobster would probably help.
Well, maybe we'll revisit this conversation later on, but I think we should pause to note that all of the number nines talked about, Nosedive, Wiener, and The Lobster, you could watch right now through your Netflix, your DVD, your Amazon Prime, your iTunes. Go out there, check out the number nines. They're all good. But just pause, though. Don't stop, because we're going to keep going. For number eight, Katie has the controversial documentary pick of the year.
I called an audible and I changed this.
Oh, shit.
So it was going to be OJ Made in America. I was going to do OJ Made in America, and then I thought about it. I've watched it in chunks. I honestly have like much stronger feelings about that maybe not being a film than I do about Nosedive. I admire that movie a lot, but I decided to switch it for a movie that may or may not come up again, The Witch.
Oh, shit.
Which every year there is a horror movie that I steal myself to watch because everyone has talked about it enough, and this year it was The Witch, which I watched home alone, sitting next to my baby with all the lights on. I didn't do the thing that I did for The Babadook, which is look up the plot summary on Wikipedia ahead of time so that I wouldn't be too scared. Which I'm really glad I didn't, because there's like, it's not like there's twists, but where this movie goes is really satisfying not to know in advance. And it just, it stuck with me. It's got a mood and a vibe. I mean, it's set in colonial England, so everyone talks with thous and these, and it's, you know, these kind of crazy people living out on a farmstead, and it's I mean, we've talked about this movie a lot, so I don't know how much detail I need to go into, but even though I think it's a bummer the life that it projects for the heroine, at the girl Thomas at the center of it, it's pretty accurate. So from a lady point of view, I liked it, and then from a horror newbie weenie's point of view, I survived it, and you can too. And those twins are assholes, man. Like, I'm not ready for toddlers.
Yeah, the scariest, oh, the scariest part of The Witch is seeing your future raising children.
I know. Like best case scenario is the tiny baby who, you know, not so spoiler alert, doesn't make it through most of the movie.
Does not make it through most of the movie.
This is not a movie that spares the baby. This is a movie that targets the baby with extreme prejudice.
Indeed. So I've kept a close eye on my baby ever since.
Nice. Well, I'm usually not a fan of, you know, audibles because I'm looking at a list, but I do appreciate that someone brought up The Witch, because when David brought it up, I completely forgot that was this year, and I also enjoyed the shit out of The Witch, and brought it to my girlfriend. I'm like, hey, this is not a horror movie as much as it's kind of a creepy period piece about coming of age in a certain time of America, and that's how I baited her into doing that. But if you guys want to see
not a horror
from
movie
the witch,
about the witch, I don't want to open that can of worms. Never mind.
Yeah, I mean, neither. I think it could be both.
Well,
I think...
Patches.
Oh God.
You guys will be nice to know that in episode 108 of Fighting in the War Room, do horror movies have to be really scary? We talked about the witch, and also in episode 107, we have a review segment of the witch.
Awesome.
So if people want to get down on the witch, head to fightinginthewarroom.com. Look up those episodes I just talked about, because pretty great. And if not, see The Witch, then check out the episodes, because I'm pretty sure we talk about the ending. Anyway, continuing on with our countdown, Patches, number eight, I'm going to say this surprised me. You picked Sing Street.
Really? Why does that surprise you?
With looking at your full list, I feel like you were going in a slightly different like narrative direction, and I think Sing Street kind of surprised me, but you explain to me why it's on your list,
because it
and I'll
fills
tell
me
you
with
if I was
joy
wrong.
Because I am an Irish man who loves to sing in his spare time when I'm around home.
Mm.
And this filled my heart with joy. This is John Carney's musical comedy drama thing about coming of age story about kids in the mid 80s in Dublin trying to make it as rock stars or figuring out what rock means to them in terms of their kind of fractured lives and resolving problems through music. It just really spoke to me. I was surprised, you know, played at Sundance. I did not catch it there. And sometimes there are things that play at Sundance where the right people are cheering for it and calling it a crowd pleaser, and you immediately decide never to see that movie. It's just too much.
What are you stuck with?
To anyone who enjoyed Captain Fantastic.
Oh shit! Yeah, not my style. But Sixth Street, I caught up with, and I was so glad I did. I saw it in theater, and loud, very loud speakers. And it deserves it. The music is great. I mean, this is not like John Carney's previous film Once, which I adore, which is grounded and real and textured and, you know, about adults trying to make it. This is kids, and it's loud and screaming and punk and every shade of rock expressing itself through the kind of like unconstrained, you know, it's bursting out of these kids. And that's what I love about it. And it wears its heart on its sleeve, and it's a gorgeous looking movie around shot around Dublin. And I don't know, Katie's on board. I think it'll probably come up again, but I don't know,
might
just
come up
full
again.
Of joy. I need a really positive movie. And for some people, I know that's like La La Land and some other things. And I don't know, this is a shaggier movie. And I think that plays up for me.
I think the shagginess, I could kind of read that. I was just surprised because it's sort of like you're on a theme of, I think, some, like, you know, focused on maybe individuals and their perspectives.
Mm.
And so Sing Street, I feel, is the joyous pick from you this year.
But it's also,
the perfect
cast. I don't think any of the movies on my list are, like, really ensemble pieces. I'm trying to think. I'll have to look again, but
right,
perfect cast.
Charlie's here.
He did
hey, Charlie,
not die
what's
from
up?
The witch.
But yeah, you got to keep him close, otherwise he might be taken away. Or maybe he likes Sing Street too, and he's going to break out in song, and we'll get that.
He watched Sing Street.
Yeah, we'll get that precious moment of Charlie becoming movie sentient.
Charlie, who cannot speak, we will start singing.
It'll be great. It's like that Warner Brothers frog where nobody believes us. Speaking of singing and dancing and joy, David, I hear you like La La Land.
I do. I do really like La La Land. I really liked La La Land the first time I saw it, and then I saw it again last night, and I liked it about twice as much, which seldom happens for me because I get stir crazy sometimes when I'm seeing movies for the second time. It had been a few months, but everything. I think the first time that I saw La La Land, I didn't know what it was going to be. I said that to a friend of mine who was like, "It's going to be a cute movie between Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone singing," and he's not wrong. But I was not expecting it to be. I can't remember how it was that I described it the first time around. That it was sort of a movie. A romance about movies that became a movie about romance. I wasn't expecting that transition. I wasn't expecting sort of the bottom to fall out and the musical elements of it to disintegrate a little bit as it went on, and the central relationship began taking on the contours of real life, and dreams began fading a little bit, and then things got more difficult. I think the way that Damien Chazelle leverages the language of movie musicals in order to chip away at them and then reveal what's underneath is fascinating. But it can lead some people, I think, especially on first watch, to feel like the second act is a little dead towards the end of the second act. And that was a criticism that I agreed with for a little while and no longer do. Watching it again, seeing that coming, putting it in the greater context of how these characters are wrestling with their dreams, and that, you know, sort of negotiating between their dreams and the reality of their dreams at the expense of other people in their lives, how we help people to achieve those things versus how we can sometimes stunt their growth, what is the value of all these different things, what is the value of, to go back to our Love Witch conversation, you know, can you be a revolutionary if you are such a traditionalist? How do we get people to go see the movies and keep them alive if we are just trying to fawn over a dead or dying art form? If you are going to assume that argument, I think I know Charlie. Charlie's with me on this one. But
he loves that.
But I think that the movie is a lot more clever and engaged than even I was ready to give it credit for the first time around, as much as I liked it and already sort of put it rather high on my top 10 list.
Here's what I like about this.
Yeah.
You're basically saying that the movie improved once you knew the shape of it and were able to examine it knowing the shape of it, which is my like whole argument for spoilers.
But I only had that perspective and sort of the ability to see the movie in this way, I think, and understand how I thought of it pure because I saw it the first time knowing absolutely nothing. In the same
sure.
way.
I mean, it's just nice for me who, you know, this movie just came into my town last Friday, whereas some other people have been getting to check it out via screener, the Showtime or whatnot. So I kind of feel like I already have a grip on what La La Land is,
yes,
and then listening to you guys review it.
I do think that you would be doing yourself a tremendous disservice if you went out and like found out how it ended before you saw it, for example.
Oh, like Wikipedia, the ending shot or
yes.
something?
Yes. Yeah, that would be a big mistake, especially considering that the last 10 minutes and change of La La Land are so phenomenal.
They all
really
die.
As good at,
just like Rogue One.
Just like Rogue One.
And the last 10 minutes are good in a way that Wikipedia
yeah,
isn't going
to this is true, not to
anything.
Further encourage you to go read about what happens, but it, this is a story that is all in the telling. And I thought that Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone, while not destined for the inevitable Broadway version of this movie, where they will be replaced by people who are much, much, much better.
Why does everyone forget that Emma Stone was on Broadway not too long ago?
Oh, in Chicago?
Yeah.
I mean, she's definitely
Cabaret.
She's in Cabaret.
She's a much better singer than he is. I don't think either of them are like world-class singers, but I also think that whatever flaws they may have as singers are part of the charm of the movie. I think that like if they were just incredible singers, I think it would sort of burst the scrappiness and the fact that like they don't know if they deserve the success that they're angling for. They don't know if their dreams deserve to come true for them, if they are good enough. I think if every time she opened her mouth, the voice of an angel came out, it would disassemble the movie a little bit. I think it's enough that Ryan Gosling learned how to play these complex, sort of very fast-paced jazz piano things.
I know the guy who taught him his hat choreography.
Yeah, and
he lives in Denver.
Very strong hat choreography
sweet.
Here. And the bits that are not sort of commenting necessarily on classic musicals, but simply are exulting in what made them so fun, are also spectacular. The first scene in particular, if there's any movie this year not to show up late to, it is La La Land, because the first shot or scene that is meant to look like one shot and stitched together from a couple of them is just sensational and immediately captures and revitalizes everything that you, or I at least, love from films from Singin' in the Rain and The Bandwagon to The Young Girls of Rochefort and Umbrellas of Cherbourg, and to have more Demi references and beyond. And I think that how this film sort of interpolates the past of movie musicals is part of what makes it great. Not that it simply copies it and updates it into contemporary Los Angeles, but how fluent it is with that past. And I can speak to that a lot more than I can to however rigorous the movie's thoughts are about jazz. I think that the way the movie uses jazz is effective, but jazz experts tend to take issue with Damien Chazelle and how Ryan Gosling's character sees the jazz world, and that's fine. But I do think that it probably uses jazz in a way very similar to how it uses the past of movies, which are sort of both of those ideas are interspersed freely. And I think conceptually, at least, it works very well. And it made me feel very strongly. And I think that this is a movie that, as with any Best Picture frontrunner, and compound that with any sort of jubilant Best Picture frontrunner made by like a white 31-year-old, is bound for trouble. But I, who have too often to count been accused of being dead inside by the movies that I don't enjoy, and hate that line of thinking, I still thought that this was a really beautiful film.
David, the fact that you love La La Land and I don't is not the most surprising thing to happen in 2016, but it's close.
Well, have you seen it? Have you seen it twice yet? Let me see it again.
No, and I'm genuinely looking forward to my second viewing because I like what you're saying about liking something better, knowing the shape of it.
You did?
Okay. I did, actually. I saw the first time I saw it was in a theater. So my second viewing will be on a screener. I've been struggling a lot, and we've talked about this, about why La La Land doesn't totally work for me. But I do.
We have an episode to point to for that.
There's a lot that I like about it. We do indeed.
We do.
Probably knows the number.
It was recent, and I'm going to look it up right now. But I was
no pressure.
I was going to see La La Land last night.
The Witch, and that wasn't even on my list.
Oh yeah, I was going to see La La Land last night, and ended up getting like literally frozen out of. Being able to get to the theater, so that was unfortunate. But if you want to hear our thoughts on La La Land, you go to episode 147. Beware, it's also our Westworld spoiler conversation, so maybe jump off early if that's not your bag.
When
but
you say frozen out,
to keep things real,
just watched Frozen too many times, or
no? It is. I think the highest it got was 2 degrees yesterday, and there was also snow.
Woo!
Yeah, not great. But I will see La La Land. On, it's on my 2C list. Luckily, one of these on my 2C lists I got to cross off recently, so I could introduce Katie's number 7 pick by going, Ricky Baker, Ricky Baker, Ricky Baker, oh, Ricky Baker. Shit just got real.
Oh, guys, Hunt for the Wilder People is the most delightful movie of 2020. Oh. I don't know, it's hard. There's a number of delightful movies we're going to discuss, but Hunt for the Wilder People is so fun and lovely and thoughtful and heartfelt. It's a coming-of-age story that is not like The Witch at all, but is also a coming-of-age story. It's got the best performance by Sam Neill since The Piano? I'm honestly not that he's been doing since the 90s. It's the story about this foster kid who's Maori or some native, he's not white, lives in New Zealand, winds up living on this farm with this couple, and then, I guess I don't even want to spoil that much about it. He winds up wandering through the woods with his foster dad or adoptive dad, who's played by Sam Neill, who didn't seem that interested in him at all. And they get up to some adventures. It's directed by Taika Waititi, who is directing
Ragnarok.
What's it called? Thor Ragnarok. I have no idea how any of this style will translate into a Marvel movie, but it's just got such a specific sense of humor. Taika Waititi is of the same kind of crowd as the Fly the Conchord guys, not just because they're from New Zealand and funny. They actually know each other. I love this movie. It just felt like totally perfect. Like when you're going through something like this and you've got particularly like a precocious, weird kid, like it can really go south fast. I'm on the record with my lack of affection for most child actors. But Julian Dennison, who it's not his first movie, which I, you know, given that he's a kind of a very fat New Zealand kid, I was surprised by. But he's terrific and he's so charismatic in the middle of this. And he and Sam Neill have such a great vibe about them. And a special shout out to, I thought I had her name pulled up, but the girl who is one of the native people who they run into who has
a fantastic
sense of humor.
And can't stop talking.
Yeah, and I was thinking, can't stop talking. I was going to say it was Rachel House, but that's not her. Anyway, she's great. Lots of great little side characters in this. And
there's definitely a scale. There's a scale to this movie.
You make it feel good, and
this
it's on
an
iTunes.
Action movie. I don't know. You don't see a Marvel movie in here?
Yeah, that's true. Well, so the end of the movie, which kind of basically is Mad Max, and I think is very deliberately a reference to Mad Max, that definitely feels like a Marvel movie. I'm more talking about like the sense of humor and like the kind of the lightness of touch to it, which is something all Marvel movies need. So I'm really looking forward to see how those emerge. But it's got it's just so distinctive in its voice that I worry about Marvel.
You think Wes Anderson, while he's making his new stop motion movie, like saw this and just threw his copy of Moonrise Kingdom in the trash?
Wow.
Whoa.
Yeah, I like it so much more than Moonrise Kingdom.
I was just about to say, like, remember when I was saying how I hate when people are like, oh, anyone who doesn't like this movie must be dead inside. And then anyone who doesn't like The Hunt for the Wilder People must be dead inside, surely. But back the fuck off, Moonrise Kingdom. Thanks.
No, Moonrise Kingdom has, you know, great parts that I love rewatching, but if I want to rewatch a full, you know, this arc, I think Hunt for the Wilder People is more on pitch for me.
Don't give me reason to dislike Hunt for the Wilder People.
What, we got Grand Budapest Hotel, which is like a goddamn masterpiece. Moonrise Kingdom is pleasant. It's pleasant. No, I don't know.
Guys, topical Moonrise Kingdom reference. The kids from Moonrise Kingdom are in Patterson. They have seen it.
Hey.
It's great.
Oh. That makes me kind of want to see it. Oh, that can't be spoiled any more than Patches did right before the podcast, right?
God damn it.
That's true. Ricky Baker.
Ricky Baker.
Hunt for the Wilder People. So good. It's on Amazon, according to IMDb. I watched it on iTunes. It's great.
He's fantastic. Patches, you're number 7. I don't think we've talked about it on the podcast before. Hit us up. Drop some knowledge.
I wasn't sure. So my number 7 is Krisha, which I think actually won an Independent Spirit Award last year. I don't really know how release schedules and award season works.
Independent Spirit Awards are particularly, they use a different calendar, so.
The director, Trey Edward Schultz, who also wrote the movie, won John Cassavetes and a low budget award from them last year, but this movie came out in March, so it definitely counts. A24 picked it up, gave it a very small release, barely a release, but now it's on Amazon, so you can definitely watch it, and I highly recommend it, clearly. This is a major, major movie. Trey Edward Schultz, he was like an intern, or he worked on some Terrence Malick movies in post-production, I think. He may have worked on The Tree of Life.
And he's definitely picking up some philosophy, some camera work ideas from Malick. But after a year that gave us two Terrence Malick movies, Trey Edward Schultz has made the best Terrence Malick movie. And that's reductive because I think it's really individual on his own too. He may be lifting this kind of gliding camera work and methodical direction and contemplative tone.
I think the gliding camera work is really all that he's, if anything.
Yeah. Because
I don't think this is much of a Terrence Malick movie.
Well, no, okay. I was being reductive. I was making a point. But I'm blowing past it because this is a very personal story for him. He basically cast his whole family. The lead is this woman, Krisha. She's in her 60s. She is an addict, and she is, I don't know, she has broken down several times, and she barely sees her family, but she's going to for the first time in a long while on Thanksgiving dinner, which I don't know who would recommend doing that, because all Thanksgiving dinners are terrifying, just epicenters for conflict and loud conflict. But Krisha comes to dinner and tries to make good, and she can't. She's spiraling out of control, and this movie gets in her head through the camera work, gliding through this house, this kind of, you know, McMansion in Texas, as she is navigating the sea of people, all her family, her son, it's been a little while since I've seen the movie, but her son now lives with her sister in this house because of Krisha's addiction. So she hasn't seen him in a while. So they're going through conflict, and her addictions cannot be quelled. She is breaking out. She's drinking in the house and in the bathroom and having this miserable breakdown. And it's Thanksgiving, so everyone is already on edge. And Schultz just captures it with this telescopic lens. It's intense. The music is erratic and crazy. Just, if you love like the Mika Levy scores from Jackie or Under the Skin, it's very similar to that, but even wackier and even more jarring and jagged. It really made this, amplified everything in this movie for me. It is a stunning piece of work. And again, as I mentioned, Schultz cast his whole family. So they're not really, he's not working with actors. He's working with people he knows. Like Krisha is played by his aunt, his real aunt. So there's some really personal filmmaking in this. And I don't know, it blew me away.
Yeah, that's got to be really interesting. In terms of like pulling like ensemble performances, you've got maybe another choice that's going to work on your list, but would you say Krishna is your acting ensemble choice for the year?
Just Krishna.
Nope. Krisha. Sorry. Krisha. I keep fucking...
Yeah, I made a dumb claim.
Got it. Krisha. Yeah.
I made a dumb claim Krisha. When I was talking about Sing Street, saying that I wasn't like gravitating towards ensembles. That is totally not true. I have a bunch of ensemble pieces coming up. So I don't know if Krisha is the number one acting ensemble. It's not, because there's movies above it. But I'm not like blown away by any individual performance in this so much as just how they're all working clockwork as he kind of navigates through all of this friction. It's dazzling, and it will give you, it will probably give you a mental breakdown, but I like that.
Was that you specifically for me, Dave Gonzalez?
No, you, the audience. Well, probably you too.
Okay. Got it. I mean, I do like good movie cinema-triggered mental breakdowns.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, maybe, I don't know. David, literally tell me about The Fitz. I have no idea what this is.
The Fitz is a movie about my childhood as a young black girl growing up in inner city America somewhere. It is a movie by Anna Rose Holmer that very quietly premiered in Venice last year. It was financed through a program related to the festival, and then had a similarly quiet bow at Sundance. And as soon as people started to watch it, really became the talk of the festival, at the very least. It's hard to be the talk of the festival, of a festival where Birth of the Nation and Manchester by the Sea premiered. But The Fitz was definitely being mentioned. Its shadow was much larger than the movie itself. It's a small 80-minute movie about a girl who's played by the incredible newcomer. She's like 11 in the movie, Royalty Hightower, which is also the best new actor name of 2016. And she is... most of the movie takes place in this gym in a gray, overcast city somewhere in America, where she is... the boxing ring where all the teen boys spar with one another is right down the hall from the dance studio where all the teen girls dance. And this character played by Royalty Hightower is a bit split between those two worlds. She's a girl and therefore put into a certain box, but she would rather box than dance. And on top of all of this, as she peers through windows and tries to figure out her place in the world and find her voice and determine who she has to be, a sickness of some kind begins to filter its way through the facility. Every so often, one of the girls who's dancing begins to have seizures, fits, and they survive.
Oh, shit. I got it.
Yes, but it's very alarming, although and sort of inexplicable. And what Anna Rose Homer ultimately does with that device, how she uses it to help her heroine transcend the limitations of the way that she's been able to, the boxes that she's been put in and how she's been able to see this world, is extraordinarily beautiful. This is a film that feels lived in and really well built up and imagined, and has so much to say about, in its 80 minutes, about all the various topics that it covers. And it's really just, at its essence, just beautiful storytelling rooted in movement and sort of physical expression. There are very few words spoken in the movie. And it all really hangs together to have a coherent, beautiful feel about it. And its ending in particular, and the song to which it's set, I mean, it's as beautiful as anything you'd see in a movie screen this year.
I think it's also streaming nice, on Amazon Prime if you want to watch it.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm not sure if it has a wide theatrical release that people could pick up.
It came out earlier this year. Well, Oscilloscope released it, and Oscilloscope releases are of a certain size, but that is definitely available in high quality digital means wherever you look for your good movies.
Make use of that 4K TV you bought last year on Black Friday and have been watching nothing on, you crazy people. Moving right along, we're at number 6, which is going to be the end for this part 1 of the episode, so we're going to close out with a Katie Patches David pick, starting with Katie, with our first repeat, I think.
I think so. It's The Lobster.
Hey!
We've talked about this movie a lot. As David said, it feels like it's been out for a while, and I didn't even see it until earlier this year, but I feel like I've lived 3 lifetimes since then, election being the major
and
one
you
for
created
all of us.
A life. A life but,
yeah.
And I created a life. Yeah, I went and saw The Lobster at BAM, right before Charlie was born, being like, I won't be able to go to the movies anymore, and oh, I was so right. But I think we didn't talk about quite enough is just how funny it is. There's a lot of really great actors in it, given these incredibly dry, weird lines that everyone is really selling incredibly well. So even though it's this kind of weird, dark look at relationships, it's funny and often darkly funny, but then sometimes just so straight up weird and funny. And I enjoyed it immensely.
Lobster. I mean, yeah. Now, thanks to this conversation, now I can't stop thinking about Colin Farrell, like, working out, being like, gotta be a wizard. Gotta be a wizard.
Which is not in The
Which
Lobster.
Which is not in The Lobster. No, that's... I mean, go see The Lobster for Rachel Weisz, then afterwards think about Colin Farrell working out. That seems to be what I'm suggesting. Patches, I tried to Google this your pick, and here's what Wikipedia says about the plot. The film has 3 parts set in 1999, 2014, and in Australia in the year 2025, respectively.
Right. There are two
end
movies
plot.
This could be.
It's Captain America Civil War. No. My movie is the latest film from David, correct me on my pronunciation, Jia Zhangke.
I mean, I think that's very wrong, but I don't want to be the guy who's like, here are the ways.
How would you say it? How would you say it?
I say Zhangke.
What is it?
Zhangke.
Zhangke. Okay. Well,
that sounds righter, but
Zhangke.
Also I have no
okay.
idea.
I'll go with Zhangke. That sounds right. So anyway, this is his latest film, and it came out, I think, in January. Got a very, very small release. It's now on Netflix. If you want to see this triptych, that really just gave me such insight.
Say the title.
Into the Chinese life. Modern Chinese life. I'm not connected to that experience at all. But this is a very low key, rambling movie, with spurts of humor and darkness and sadness. And it's about identity
and trying to prevail and trying to hold on to it as the world around you changes. Oh, did I not say what it is? It's Mountains May Depart.
That's what I said. Say the
okay,
movie.
I'm so sorry. Okay. Okay. It's Mountains May Depart. And, it stars, this actress Tao Zhao as a woman named Tao. And as Dave mentioned, it takes place in 99, 2014 and 2025. And it follows her over the course of those decades and watches her fall in love, fall out of love, connect with other men, connect with her family, watch, you know, have a son, and then watch her world change so dramatically. I think a few episodes ago on the podcast, we talked about the film Lion, which is, you know, kind of an Oscar contender, I guess. But that film is about an Indian kid who goes and moves to, he loses his family and gets separated and then migrates to Australia when he's adopted and struggles to figure out his life in Australia and find his home. And Mountains Made Apart is actually very similar to that, because the third section takes place in Australia, which is so, it's so interesting. And in the future, where identity doesn't seem to play a big part for the Chinese immigrants there, but for Tao, who remains in China throughout that section, she creates this fissure in what Chinese identity is, and her son ends up going to Australia. I don't think that's a huge spoiler, but he's the one who's kind of totally removed. He doesn't even feel Chinese. He doesn't speak Chinese anymore. And it's just, there's so much nuanced character work in these three pieces of this film. I don't really know how to describe it in a brief way, but I urge you to check it out because I think it's one of the most stunning performances of the year from Tao Zhao, and it just came out of nowhere for me. David, did you see this one? Of course.
I saw it in Toronto in 2015 and enjoyed it very much. The third act, which has been problematic for a lot of people, did not bother me.
Same, yeah.
I also think it's worth pointing out that it wears the future very lightly. And I don't think that my expectations were that it was going to be a lot more disruptive, but, what it does with dislocation and how that pertains to cultural identity, national identity is very interesting. I think Zha Zhangka has a very, he has always been a little bit of a futurist in a way. I mean, he made a film called The World a few years ago that takes place in a, really run down theme park in rural China that is built, that has like, it's sort of like their Epcot Center. And it's really interesting in a lot of the same ways this is, but I wholeheartedly second Patches' endorsement for this movie, was near making my list. It's a very strong film. I think maybe, Zha Zhangke's most accessible movie in a long time. And I think, all of his movies are talking to people about his next movie. I feel like that's probably the direction that he's trending in. But he is just a fascinating, I mean, he's one of the most fascinating filmmakers alive right now. And, if this is a movie that will, help you into his body of work, or maybe, in my case, it definitely helped clarify a lot of things that, and give new language to a lot of things about his films that I had struggled to put into words. Highly recommend.
It also has the best.
And it's got great dancing.
Yes, great dancing, great music, and the best use of the village people in any movie ever. The song "Go West" plays a very, very important role. Mountains May Depart. It's on Netflix.
Yep, it's on Netflix. Yep. It's on Amazon Video, YouTube, iTunes, Vudu, and Google Play and Movies.
Damn, I didn't know that was.
Yeah, I mean either. But apparently, there are people who use it as a service, so we don't want to leave them out of excellent movies. David, don't blink, because your number six pick is up right now.
Oh, right. I get it.
You forgot what that was?
I get the reference.
There we go.
Yes. When you're listening to a podcast, you can blink as much as you want. it is Kubo and the Two Strings. Hopefully, the last movie I ever have to make the argument of its racism doesn't get in the way of how much I enjoyed it.
There's no way that's the last movie you can say that about.
It's an interesting case. I think the whole whitewashing controversy around Kubo, I think is worth addressing. It's a lot. I think there's something particularly insidious about it, just because representation often talks about invisibility, and that's really what it's fighting against. And the idea of being able to use animation as sort of a Trojan horse through that, not to put it, representation in there, but to sort of, Trojan horse is a bad analogy, but to sort of pave over it, is dangerous because when you're watching these characters who can be made to look like however they are, you don't think so much about who is voicing them, of what race and racial makeup the cast is, and so you can hide a lot of stuff in there. That being said, and I think that hopefully Laika learned the lesson from the blowback that they received, regardless of the fact that the performances are uniformly excellent across the board, these are not mutually exclusive ideas. You can say that the film is great and that these performances are great and still recognize that the means by which it was made are problematic and not problematic in the hashtag problematic, but problematic in a real way that I think stirred appropriate controversy and hopefully will be addressed in the future. That being said, this is far and away the best animated film of the year. For me, it's not even close. Kubo, the new film from Laika, who have made films like Coraline and The Box Trolls and Paranorman, and that's all their films, so I shouldn't have to say like. But I just thought this was such not only a staggeringly beautiful movie to look at, which it is, and to listen to, thanks to a great score that is iced off with one of the better Beatles covers I've ever heard, by Regina Spektor, is just such a knowing and smart and hopeful and bittersweet portrait of grief and growing up and the ways in which we carry the people that we've lost with us and how they shape who we are. I don't even want to say like for a kid's movie, although I was definitely caught by surprise by how strong this movie struck me. And really for any film, I just think it's how it uses sort of the typical hero's journey to explore some of these things and dramatize them. I just thought it was so affecting and clever. And again, just accurate. I mean, really true to my experience and it isn't afraid to embrace that. It doesn't sugarcoat any of this stuff. The ending is so perfect and on point. And, any movie, race controversy aside, where Rooney Mara is voicing two evil, twin ghost sisters is fine by me.
Of course you like that. Now, what if I liked Zootopia better?
You're wrong. And we'll move on to, closing out here. That was 10 through 6 of our 2016 top 10s. I don't want to take too much of your time, so just tell you to be back at fightinginthewarroom.com next week for the thrilling conclusion 5 through 1. Have a happy holidays. We'll talk to you soon.